Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is Professor Jonah Perlin from Georgetown Law School. Jonah, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, we're glad you're here, too. For our Texas listeners, I imagine most of them probably don't know you. I guess some of them may know you from Twitter, but tell us a little bit about who you are, kind of your background, that kind of thing.
Sure. I'm a professor at Georgetown Law. I'm also an alum of the law school. I came to Georgetown and joined the faculty as a visitor about 3.5 years ago. I teach legal practice, which has different names, different places. It's formerly known as legal research and writing. So my class is dedicated to teaching mostly first-year students. I teach some advanced classes, but mostly first-year students about how to write, how to act as lawyers, how to practice as lawyers, small things as part of the 1L curriculum. And I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, and I live in Washington, D.C. now with my wife and two kids.
What's the thinking behind the switching of the name from legal research and writing to legal practice?
Sure. As with anything, there's a lot in a name. And I think different places have used different terminology. Traditionally, it was thought of as a skills class, hence the sort of what are those skills, writing and research. The name switch happened before I came back to Georgetown, but I always think of it as sort of rethinking what our mission is in a much broader sense. And so if our mission is to introduce students, and I tell students from day one, I only get 40 class hours with them over the course of the whole year. So one work week there with me in the classroom. They do a lot of work outside the classroom as well, but I am introducing them to the practice of law. Now, as you both know, and we all know, being a lawyer is kind of being a professional writer. There are practice areas where it's not, where you are a professional public speaker or a professional advisor. But for many lawyers, writing is our bread and butter. That's how we do our profession. And so that is sort of the core skill of the legal practice class. But other schools call it different things. Lawyering fundamentals is another title. But I like to think it allows me to think a little bigger, think a little broader about what I'm teaching my students.
So how did you get into teaching? Like, what was your path from law school to faculty?
Sure. That's a great question. And it's a question I get a lot from students and from others out there. So I graduated from Georgetown Law. I practiced at a law firm, Williams & Connolly in Washington, D.C., where I was a sort of general civil litigator for a year. And then I went and was lucky enough to clerk for two just incredible judges, Ellen Siegel-Huvel, who was a judge here on the District Court of D.C. She's recently retired. And then Chief Judge Katzman of the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in New York. He unfortunately recently passed, but was just an incredible mentor and incredible judge to work for as well. And then I went back to Williams & Connolly and I thought I was just going to be a litigator. I really liked litigating. I liked getting to know my clients. I liked the partners I worked with. The firm was fantastic. It was sort of a trial by fire approach to being a civil litigator. The best way to learn how to be a lawyer in my experience is to just be a lawyer. And that was their sort of philosophy. I had three first days at that law firm. I was a summer associate. I was an associate. And then I came back after my clerkships. But a couple of years in, I started thinking, maybe I don't necessarily want to be a litigator, at least at a big firm for the rest of my life. What might be next? As way would have it, my dear friend from when I was at Georgetown was teaching as an adjunct in the night program at Georgetown. He was teaching a legal writing class on judicial clerkships, which sort of I had a similar background to him. And he was lucky enough to get a clerkship with Justice Sotomayor. So he couldn't teach for the year. And he said, "Hey, Jonah, I know you're interested in sort of trying this teaching thing out. Would you have any interest in taking my class?" It was a horrible time in my professional and personal life to take that on. I was really busy at work. We had just had our second kid, but I had always thought maybe teaching was in my cards. I did a master's before I went to law school, thinking I might go the PhD route eventually. But I said, let's just try it. Tried it for the semester. realized I liked being a litigator and I loved being a legal writing teacher. And I said, it's time. I got to find my way to get back into the classroom. And as luck would have it, Georgetown was hiring for a visiting position. And thankfully, that one semester was enough to kind of get me the visiting position. And the visiting position was enough to ultimately let me apply to the full-time position. And now I truly feel really lucky. I get to do something that I love every single day. So one moment, one clerkship that wasn't mine really changed my whole trajectory.
That's a cool story. It's interesting how those little ripples kind of come out and have effects on people that you could never even have imagined.
Absolutely. It's a good reminder, and I tell this story to my students a lot, that other people's success can actually be a part of your success, even if you don't know it. And the fact that that one classroom experience confirmed for me that this was the right path was something I tell my students all the time, take small bets, do things. And if at the end of the semester, you realize what you really don't like doing is teaching in a classroom, you never have to do it again. But having that sort of like light introduction allowed me to realize I wanted to do it and give me the experience that candidly I needed to be a good candidate when a position opened up. The other thing I'll add is I had actually thought if I was going to go become an academic, I wanted to teach legal practice, then legal research and writing. And I had gone back to my professor, who is one of my mentors now, is still at Georgetown, Chris Tishoni, and said, hey, I'd love to do what you do. And she told me no three times over the course of years. She said, you're not ready. You're not experienced enough. You're not going to enjoy it. She basically told me all the reasons I wasn't going to like it. When I came back to her the third time, she finally said, okay, you clearly want to do this. Let's figure out how to make it happen. So those sort of two experiences are what set me on my current professional path.
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge.
Now that you have been teaching this for several years, are there things that you've learned on the teaching side of it that you kind of wished you'd known in practice?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the challenges is when you get to practice, there's this, especially as a litigator, at least in my experience, I can only speak to that, but there's a lot of learning by doing, right? Lawyers, that's how we train. That's kind of our bread and butter. We don't have that British model of being an apprentice somewhere. Instead, you're a barred attorney. And the best way to learn how to take a deposition, in my experience, was to just have to take one. And it's scary. And you really don't want the deponent knowing that it's your first, but it has to have a first. A joke I often make with my students is every pilot has to land a plane the first time. They just don't tell the passengers that it's their first landing, right? You got to just do it. And I love that ethos. And I think that's the right mental model for training lawyers. But I think now having come back to the classroom, what I've seen is that there are people who are really thinking critically over years and years on how to do this job well. And I think academics can actually get a bad rap that they're sort of so far away from the practice, at least people who teach what I teach. And there are a lot of us out there and we're growing. Think critically about what makes a good piece of legal writing. Not what do I like, not just what do the judge that I clerked for like, but what writ large makes a good piece of writing and what is a really good process on how to do that. There's a great professor, a guy named Joe Ford at the University of Virginia, who wrote a whole article about how we convey certainty in legal memos. And he compared it to a bunch of different other professions about, well, what does the phrase probably mean? Is that 50%? Is that 60%? Is that 70%? In my experience as a lawyer, no one really told me what probably meant in a memo to a client. I just sort of made it up as I was going along and I learned wisdom of those who came before me. So it's a long answer to the question, but what I think I've learned is that there are people out there who have made this their professional life to think critically about how to be a better lawyer. And the practice could really use greater sort of interactions with those people and what they do, because there's a lot of great writing out there about being a lawyer that I don't think lawyers get to see. And I don't know how to make that happen. I'm trying to make that happen myself through social media, through the podcast, through my students, but it's a challenge.
It is, because one, I guess, disadvantage of practice is you don't necessarily have the time or the bandwidth to go seek those things out, especially in the litigation side. It's putting out fires and
totally
prepping for the next thing and the next thing. And the last thing you want to do is sit down and read a legal writing journal, unfortunately, although everyone could probably benefit from doing it.
Totally. I'm with you. And who are you going to bill it to? I mean, time is money in the profession, and I totally get that. And that's why I think finding more creative ways than just saying, hey, what was in this month's Journal of Legal Communication, but rather, I need to do X task for the first time. Let's just check to see if someone has already written about how to do that task, as opposed to, I think the one challenge of doing it and figuring it on your own is there's a lot of inefficiency to that as well, because you're just kind of the novice leading the novice trying to figure out what's next. And so finding those connections, building that community can be super powerful.
We haven't really had a guest on who has talked much about the federal clerkship process and tips, but I know we've heard from some listeners kind of asking those questions. Can you kind of give us sort of an overview on the federal clerkship process and then maybe some tips for listeners who are interested in going that route?
Sure. I will say that it is a constantly moving target to a degree. The federal clerkship process has changed several times, even since I was applying just about a decade ago. And as a student, then helping select clerks as a law clerk myself, and now writing recommendations for my students, I've sort of seen all the pieces, and it changes a lot. So that's the short answer. The longer answer is today, if you want to apply for a clerkship, the idea is there's a lot of people out there who want to do this job. And there are a lot of people out there who are very qualified to do this job. And judges don't have the same apparatus that even private law firms have to sort of select who the right people are. And they're hiring for very small numbers. And so the process is pretty old school in a lot of ways. It's send a cover letter, send a resume, send some recommendations. There's a sort of centralized hub called OSCAR, but not all judges participate in it. That's the other thing I'll add, is every judge has their own hiring process and they are allowed to do that. And in many cases are encouraged to do that. So even if there is a hiring plan and there is currently a hiring plan, thanks in part to my old boss, Judge Katzman, which is an effort to make it more normalized, more fair, clearer about what the path is, but not everybody participates in it. So you send those materials out. And for someone who's never sort of thought about how this works, I like to think of this happening in two steps. So step one is get your resume from the pile of, it could be 1,000. I mean, I think I've heard something like a district court judge here in DC, which is a very popular place to clerk for lots of reasons, might get 1,000 applicants for one or two spots a year, right? So your goal at that point is to send in materials that help you get from 1,000 into the pile of, say, 15 or 20 that the judge is going to read closely, maybe 50. Now, there are judges I know who read every application. That's very difficult if you're getting that volume. That's not your full-time job, right? These are people you're hiring to help you do your job more quickly, not to sort of be the thing that you're doing late at night and on the weekends. So step one is getting into that smaller pile. Once you're in the smaller pile, the judge is going to go through everything, learn everything they can about you from your written materials, from your references, to sort of pick who are they going to bring in to interview. In this world, I think interviews always happen in person. Now they're increasingly happening on Zoom, which I think is fantastic. It's cheaper for the applicants. It's not like a law firm where they're going to pay you to fly out for the interview. And it also allows you to interview in two different cities on the same day, which is something that I wish I had been able to do 10 years ago when I was applying. Mm-hmm. And then you have to get for those one or two spots from that pile of 15 or 20. And the key point is what you do to get from 1,000 to 20 is a little bit different than what you get from what you do to get from 20 to 2. To get from 1,000 to 20 is stand out for that judge. That could be because a professor calls who you're close with. That could be because you and the judge went to the same undergraduate institution. That could be because you list on the bottom of your resume that you're really into I don't know, Legos, and the judge is really into Legos. I don't know. I have two young kids, so Legos is on the brain. Yeah, it really is idiosyncratic. And so because of that, you can't really help yourself by figuring out which judges you're going to have the natural affinity with. Like, don't waste your time doing that, because it's just too hard to figure out what judge is going to pick me out of the pile of 1,000 to get me to the pile of 20. So the only way to fix that is increase your denominator. Apply as widely as you can and see what judges' piles you end up in. Then once they call you back and you've gone from the pile of 20, you can decide, do I want to be in their pile of 2? Maybe it's a judge who doesn't have the same political background as you. Maybe it's a judge who you've heard from other clerks doesn't treat his or her clerks very well. Or maybe it's the perfect person for you and it's going to be the greatest setup in the world. But don't do that before you sort of get into the pile of 20. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of a high level of how I explain it to people who have never done this before. If you can have advocates in the process, that can help a lot. I think increasingly judges are expecting to get calls from law professors. I tell everyone for whom I write a recommendation, I'll make up to 3 calls to any judges you want. It's even better if the judges know those people or are from the same places as those people. The other thing to ask is, has the judge hired from my law school before? A lot of judges tend to hire from the same law schools, and it becomes a way for them to sort of short circuit the system and say, I don't need to read 1,000, but I can read everyone who comes from law school X and law school Y, or has been a summer associate at this law school or in this city. They just pick these various ways, and that's how it happens.
I've seen a little bit of discussion online about clerking where you want to work or not clerking where you want to work. Do you have sort of an insight on that decision?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's something that I struggled with. I'm from the DC area. I wanted to stay in DC. And then I got this incredible opportunity to interview with Judge Katzmann, who was just a dream judge, both on paper and even more of a dream judge when I actually met him in person. And we didn't really have any interest in working in New York. I took some interviews for district court judges in New York. That didn't go so well when I told them I wasn't interested in staying. So I think some judges care about where their clerks are going to work. Some judges don't. Judge Katzmann has a network all over the country. In terms of benefits for you as the law clerk, I do think there are some benefits if you can find a place to clerk that you also want to practice, if you know where you want to practice. It's a good way to meet the bar. It's a good way to sort of have local mentors. As everybody knows, right? Mentors are great. Local mentors are really great. They can sort of help make that phone call or set up that meeting or just sort of help guide you. All of that said, there's a lot of value from the clerkship that just comes from doing the work. And that can happen anywhere. And so maybe you don't have a family and you don't have a plan and you're willing to go anywhere for a year. Being a law clerk, there are a lot worse ways to spend a year than being a law clerk. I actually had my clerkships lined up 3 years before I started, because that's how far out the process was when I was applying. And people looked at me like at my wedding. I was a first year associate. I was at my wedding and I said to people, oh, we're moving to New York in 24 months for me to clerk. And people looked at me like I was a crazy person, that I knew I was leaving my job and I had another job in between. And then we were moving to New York. In the time between when I got hired to work for Judge Katzmann and when I ultimately clerked for him, I got engaged, got married, and my wife was 6 months pregnant, basically. And then we had our first kid while I was clerking for him. That's a challenge for some people. There's negotiating that happens to make that a reality. At the same time, now, when I think back about it, it doesn't bother me at all that I had a plan 3 years out. I had to work somewhere. Why not spend a really fun year in New York doing it for a great judge?
Absolutely.
That timeline, it really is incredible. And then when you do what you did, which is do 2 clerkships back to back, it really does extend things out a long time. Did you know that you were going to come back to Williams and Connolly, or were you thinking about other options at that time?
Yeah, I had no real plan. I think I was like a lot of people who graduate from law school. I thought I would have these experiences and they would help me decide what I wanted to do next. And so I said, oh, I'm going to clerk for 2 years and I'll have a perfect plan by the end. By the end, I still didn't really have a plan. And I said, I really like the people I worked with at Williams and Connolly. I think I'm going to go back and see what I'm going to do next till I find my plan. But I do think it is a challenge. I think it's a challenge for the firms, candidly, to have people sort of shuttling in and out for short periods of time. the litigation process often takes many, many years. The process to become a good litigator takes many, many years. And the jumping back and forth is a challenge. But at the end of the day, just think of it as sort of time-limited opportunities, secondments, if you will, into a judge's brain. And there is nothing better for a young litigator than to sort of be a judge's brain for a period of time or be part of a judge's thinking process for a time. But yeah, the timeline's hard. And I will say it is harder often the older you are. So my students who come to law school older with families, they end up often just not clerking because they have such limited timelines and cities that they're willing to work with. Plus there are financial implications as well. So the timeline's not great, but as a reminder, and you both know this because you practice before judges all the time, judges like to set their own rules and they often benefit the judges, and that's just fine. And that's how it works.
That is something you mentioned. There's a lot of people who are qualified to do these clerkships, but the financial side of it really does come into play. I mean, there are folks who are otherwise really interested in doing it, but who just really can't afford it when they're given the debt load that they're looking at coming out of law school. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of a shame that there's a lot of good candidates that really just can't go that path because of those restrictions. And we've talked here on our show a lot about different paths to appellate practice, and judicial clerkship is kind of one of those boxes that you want to try and check if you can, but not everybody's able to do that for lots and lots of reasons. And we've emphasized, though, that it is possible to become an appellate practitioner without going that route. You just have to do things like Jody's path was having a great mentor at his law firm and kind of discovering appellate practice after he got into practice. So there's lots of different ways to do it, but there's different reasons why people want a clerk, right? There's, oh, I want to be an appellate lawyer, so a judicial clerkship is the natural fit. Or I want to get the highest paying job with the biggest, baddest law firm I can get in with. And having a federal clerkship is a good way to do that. But I wanted to ask you, I assume you also have law students who are interested in other clerkships besides federal. I mean, Georgetown, obviously being in DC, it's a little different scenario than what we see in lots of other places like here in Texas. Federal clerkships are great, but state court clerkships are, I think, sometimes undervalued and a good place to be looking if you're not necessarily one of those who's going to wind up with a federal district or appellate court clerkship.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'll tell you, it has been a blind spot to those of us who've been around sort of traditionally thought of as T14 law schools for too long, that clerkship equals federal clerkship. It doesn't. Everything I just said about the benefits of being part of a judge's thinking process happens every day at every courthouse in America, no matter how small or how big. One of my students in the class that I was an adjunct professor for came to Georgetown and had a pretty challenging first year in terms of grades. I think he'd be fine with me saying that his grades were on the lower side of his first year class. And they didn't get that much better until much later in his law school career. He was candidly GPA'd out of being a federal clerk. And he said to me in the fall of his 3L year, I know I don't necessarily have the grades, but I really liked your class about sort of clerking. I liked writing a bench memo. I like thinking about this. I'm going to apply for local clerkships. And I said, fantastic, do it. I'll write you a recommendation today. Like, let's make this happen. And he had local family. He wanted to be in the Virginia, Maryland area. And he said, I'm just going to apply to every trial court judge in Virginia and Maryland. That's as far as I'm willing to go. And I said, great, apply to all of them. Make your denominator as big as you can. Same advice. And he ended up getting a clerkship in Fairfax County local court, which is the county I grew up in, actually. And he has now come back and spoken to that class several times about how incredible being a local law clerk is. And I'll tell you, you asked a little bit about whether or not it makes sense to clerk where you're going to practice. If you know you want to practice in a place and you can clerk for the local court, for the sort of state trial court, that may be the best job you can possibly have, particularly if you're not living in sort of one of the big cities, because you have just gained so much value to being at a small but powerful local law firm, right? He would not have been looked at by a sort of 10-person big Fairfax County law firm. But once he had a clerkship, the three law firms in Fairfax County were banging on his door. And so I think it's a wonderful, wonderful experience and candidly, it's the one place where you can talk around your GPA a little bit and you can tell your story. And judges, at least I have found, tend to be willing to take a shot, even if your grades don't naturally line up at the top of the class.
I spent 2 years in law school clerking off and on for a state district judge in Houston. And it was just great because you'd go in, you'd get to watch a trial 1 week, you'd get to help read and determine summary judgments. And it was a blast because you saw everything. And if there wasn't anything going on there, you'd walk down to the criminal courthouse and there was something going on there or some big high profile trial in Houston. I got to sit in on all those things and then go back and talk to the judge and have him say, oh, here's what worked. Here's what didn't work. Here's what I loved it. It was a fantastic experience.
I've shown my own bias by only talking about appellate clerkships, but both of you have hit upon something not to be overlooked, which is federal district court clerkships or trial courts in other jurisdictions, because you get a lot of that same experience, just as you're suggesting, Jonah. You get the peek behind the curtain to see what's going on, how the process works. It really, there's so much value, no matter what level or you are, in getting those viewpoints, because as a law student, you sure don't get it. And as a practicing lawyer, you don't, if you don't have the opportunity to do this. So I'm glad y'all took that approach.
Yeah, I would just add two quick things. The first is, and Judge Katzmann was notorious for this, he only hired clerks that had a trial court clerkship first. And if you couldn't get one, he helped you find it. And that's because he fundamentally believed that to be a good appellate clerk, you had to understand how the sausage got made at the district court level. He said, you don't really understand standard of review unless you've actually decided a motion in 3 hours live from the bench, or you don't understand what it is you're actually sitting over as an appeals court judge unless you've seen that process. And so I think there's incredible value to being a trial court clerk if you want to be an appellate lawyer, which is, I know, sort of a lot of the folks that listen to your show, because you see things that people who have not been district court or trial court clerks see. You just see them. And I can't explain what they are, but you see them. And the other point I would make is one of the greatest parts about being a trial court clerk is trials take time. And you may only work on two or three or one if you're at a big law firm and you're in a huge case like I did. Maybe you're at a plaintiff side firm where you do 50 cases at a time. When you're a trial court clerk, you get hundreds of cases of experience in 1 year, mm-hmm. right? You don't have to wait for the trial process to happen. You see complaints when they come in and you see post-jury verdict motions when they come in and everything else in between. So that's one of the other benefits of being a clerk, because you sort of short circuit the problem of gaining experience in practice, which means you just have to wait till you get a case that has that issue. You just get a lot more issues. You just don't do every case from soup to nuts, start to finish.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas, or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today. Well, let's shift over a little bit. One of the things we wanted to get you on to talk about was legal podcasting. And you have recently started the How I Lawyer podcast. Tell us a little bit about what it is, how you decided to do it, and kind of where people can find it and learn about it.
Sure. Yeah. So I started the How I Lawyer podcast sort of right at the tail end of 2020. And as my students know, I like to set audacious goals for myself. Sometimes I miss them, but I'm a big believer that if you don't set audacious goals, you're never going to get close. So I set this audacious goal of doing 50 episodes in 2021. I just published episode 38. Episode 39 is on its way. So I'm hoping to hit that number by the end of the year. I was not really a huge podcast consumer, I'll be honest with you, but I was interested in doing something public facing about sort of my practice and my interests. So I took an online class late last fall about how to start a YouTube channel. So I thought I might start a YouTube channel and talk about legal writing. I thought I might start a blog or a newsletter. I just wanted to find a creative outlet for myself that was connected to what I did professionally, but was bigger than just my students, my classroom, and my scholarship. And honestly, it dawned on me one day. There's a podcast, How I Built It, by Guy Raz, who's sort of one of the best podcasters out there. My funny story about Guy Raz is his wife used to work at Williams & Connolly. She's a lawyer. We were once at a firm gala and I tied Guy Raz's bow tie for him at the hotel. And so I think that's actually how I got into podcasting, was just being that close to Guy Raz. But he started this podcast, How I Built It. I listened to a couple episodes. I listened to a couple episodes of Tim Ferriss's podcast, and I've long time been a Tim Ferriss fan. And I said, I could do this. And it doesn't have to be about me. It can be about other people. And this was like the heart of the pandemic, where people were really feeling like they had lost touch. I heard from my students, my former students, there's no conferences for me to go to. I can't even get coffee with somebody because, like, how am I even going to meet them? And then where are we going to do it? And then I have to set up a Zoom room. And so much of the legal profession, as we talked about, is passed on sort of in the hallways, right? It's passed on just by meeting people and getting to know people. And I said, why can't we do that at scale? Why can't I have a conversation that's like me having coffee with a insurance lawyer or with an appellate lawyer or with an education lawyer, and have whoever wants at any point listen in on that conversation? So I publish pretty much weekly. I don't know if I'll be able to maintain that forever, but for right now, I publish almost every week with the idea of kind of building a library that people can go back to for years to come. The amazing part is some of my most listened to episodes are not my biggest names. They're the ones that I did first. They've just been out in the world longer, and therefore there are more people listening to them. And so I just decided to start this podcast. So I interview, if you want to find it, it's howilawyer.com or wherever you subscribe to your podcasts. As I said, I publish almost every week, and it's basically my conversation, 45 minutes to an hour, with a different lawyer. And I sort of think of every episode as having three acts. The first act is, what do you do? Second act is, why do you do it? And third act is, how do you do it well? And depending on how advanced they are in their career or what their sort of general shtick is, each of those acts may be longer or shorter. But that's kind of how I think about it. And originally, I just pulled my network, people who are my friends or friends of friends. Then people started reaching out to me on a regular basis. I've had to say no to a lot of people. If you're one of those people, I apologize. It's not for lack of wanting to have the conversation, but I'm very committed to having a variety of practice areas, variety of people's, how junior or how senior they are. I want to make sure I have people of different genders and races and diversity and every sort of sense of that word featured on the show. And hopefully over time, I'll do that. I started episode one was not episode one. It was episode 001, which means I have to get to three digits, and I'm going to make that happen. I can't tell you, it has been so fun. It is exponentially more work than I expected. I do everything myself, soup to nuts. I'm my own scheduler, my own editor. I post it every Tuesday night. My wife says, guess you're going to have to post the podcast tonight. And I'm my own marketer, but I've learned so much. And the fact that I can basically email almost any lawyer in America and chances are they're going to say yes, that is just an incredible, incredible reality. I mean, the internet and podcasting and the computer age is remarkable. The fact that you can do that at scale is unheard of. And it's growing every day. And so I'm just hoping to find more people to interview, find more people to listen, ask more questions. It's helped my professional life. It's helped my personal life. It's helped me build a network. It's helped me build my own personal brand about things that I care about and connect me to people that I care about. I think I mentioned this. I took some online classes last fall when I was trying to think about what to do in the internet world. And one of them was a writing class with a guy named David Perrell. And he talks about finding your personal monopoly. And what he means by that is find the two or three things that you do or you know about that no one else does at that same level. And there may be people who know each of those two or three things at the level you do, but you're the kind of Venn diagram. You're the middle of those three in a way that nobody else is. And you'll find a community that wants to learn about it because the community, the denominator in the internet world is unlimited or functionally unlimited. So my personal monopoly was, I taught at an institution like Georgetown, which gets me into any door of any lawyer that I want to. I practiced law at a lot of big places, and that connected me to a network of people. And I had a comfort with technology and social media, which allowed me to sort of do it. And when you find your personal monopoly, just run toward it because it's an awesome experience.
That's a great concept. I love that.
I do too. I feel a lot of parallels in your story to kind of Todd and I starting this podcast on a lot of different levels. I mean, we have a little bit different focus on ours versus yours, but it's kind of the same thing. It's just been so fun during the pandemic time to be able to reach out and connect with people that we know, connect with people that we don't know. And like you said, kind of use the internet to just super network and be able to reach out to people all over the US that have similar interests and just want to come on and talk. You're absolutely right. It is so fun to be able to have those conversations and learn from people that I would frankly never have had a chance to just show up and meet in person.
Right. I mean, when we were starting, Zoom was just really taking off. Mm-hmm. And we just walked into it. I mean, it just worked out for us. The stars aligned just so. And so I do feel like you've experienced a lot of that same thing where it was like, oh, wow, my timing really couldn't have been better. Of course, it sounds like yours was sort of driven by the pandemic in some ways. And I think for us, it was more sort of a side benefit. Mm-hmm. The pandemic sort of helped us get started. Whereas you're trying to do something that helps people connect at a time that it was really difficult to connect.
100%. I think that's exactly right. I'll tell you the real aha moment. And I love asking guests on my show, when was your aha moment about any decision point? For me, it was, I want to do something creative. This is what I know about. This is my network. My aha moment was, it doesn't have to be me the one talking. Mm-hmm. That's what changed everything. A newsletter would have been about my views. My scholarship is about my views. My teaching, candidly, is about my views, albeit informed by years and years of scholarship before me. When I realized what I actually could do was amplify other people's voices and create a platform for that and a scaffold for that, that was my aha moment that this would work. And I guess just to add to the personal monopoly point, I should add, the other circle that I had is I grew up, my mom is a rabbi, one of the first 50 women rabbis in history. Wow. And what you learn as incredible. A rabbi's son, I imagine in Texas, you may have a lot more pastors' sons and daughters, but what you learn as a clergy person's child is how to talk to people, even if you don't really want to talk to them in that moment. And so I have a lot of experience talking to people about anything. And that happened to fit really well with podcasting.
It does. That is a great superpower to bring to podcasting. If you can keep a conversation going, you can always have content.
100%.
I've noticed you've had quite a few Texas connections as guests on the show.
I have.
Some people that have been on our show, as a matter of fact. I'm thinking of Rafi Malkonian and Carl Cesari.
Yeah. Some of my most listened to episodes, actually.
I recently listened to the episode with Carl and I thought it was great. And of course, Rafi, the name speaks for itself, basically, mm-hmm. as the dean of Appellate Twitter.
Sure.
So it's nice to see folks we know come on as your guests. But whenever I listen, I always learn something. It's kind of like we say about our own show. It's like we're learning as much as anybody else is because you're exposed to these different viewpoints. And all you can really do, kind of to your point about it not being about you being the one speaking all the time, sometimes all you can really do is just kind of sit back and let the conversation unfold and then just be amazed at the end when it's like, wow, that really turned out pretty neat.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'll tell you, as someone who doesn't have really any personal ties to the state of Texas, the state of Texas has been very good to the podcast. Folks are very open to telling their story, which is what I ask my guests to do. And people are willing to sort of not pitch me, that's the wrong word, but just sort of say, here's my background. If you're interested in having that story on, I'm happy to tell it. And some are sort of lifelong Texans. Some of them are transplants, but maybe it's the crossover of law podcasting and Appellate Twitter being a little bit Texas centered. But let's put it this way. The short answer is before the pandemic, I probably would not have had anyone to visit in Texas. After the pandemic, I'm hoping to be able to get a real party together, although I realize your state is a little bigger than I think it is on my map or in my head. But I've got to meet some really great people that I never would have had a chance to talk to.
Well, come down to Austin or to Fort Worth, where Jody is.
That's right.
We can get you good barbecue either place.
Sounds good. Sounds good. I look forward to it. I truly do. I'm adding Texas to my list right now for that purpose.
Are there any sort of high level takeaways or lessons that have really stuck with you from the podcast that you share with students and attorneys?
It's a great question. And it's one that I think about a lot because I don't expect that most of my listeners listen to every episode. I mean, I think my parents do. My wife does. I do have some really, really faithful listeners. Well, I have one listener in the UK who listens to every single episode and posts a tweet thread about each episode. And I never met the man, but I love him because I know someone's listening every week. But if I had to sort of pick two or three lessons that are the thread of all 40 interviews, and look, the people I interview, as I said, are diverse in every sense of that term. And I'm not afraid of putting somebody on who some people aren't going to enjoy or is not going to look like them or is not going to have the same political background that they have. Like, I want to try to get a variety. Obviously, it's going to be my personal interest and bent. It's my show. I can interview basically whoever I think is interesting, and I take that prerogative. But the thing that I hear constantly are, first, that the career path is not a straight one. And I think this is a problem of the resume LinkedIn generation. And I love LinkedIn. LinkedIn is how I met a lot of my guests and how I push out a lot of my content. And I think it's maybe the greatest thing. People hate LinkedIn. I actually think it's one of the greatest things for law student networking out there. Because if you want to find somebody who did what you want to do, you can talk to them. But the problem with LinkedIn is everything looks like when you went from job A to job B to job C to job D, that it was a straight line and it was planned from the beginning. And every person I talk to on the podcast, it only looks like a straight line when you look backwards. And being a lawyer is an awesome profession in part because it allows you to do a lot of different things, but it's also a challenging profession in part because it allows you to do a lot of different things. And there's a lot of trial and error and a lot of luck. And a lot of times where you're just as qualified as the next person and you don't get the job and you change cities and you find the love of your life and you find the practice area of your life. So one is the line's not straight. The second thing I'll say, and I was surprised by this as a message, is that networking is not evil, that networking has a horrible reputation, especially among lawyers, of like cocktail parties and bad Chardonnay and talking to people you don't want to. And law is inherently a communal business, right? We need clients. We need opposing counsel. We need other lawyers who do other things. And so you need to build community in law. And when you think of the concept of not as networking, but as of community, I think that is a huge sort of like mental model shift. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter if you're a first generation student, as so many of my students are. You don't have to bring the community or network with you. You bring whoever you have, but you then get the opportunity to build. And that could be on social media. That could be by sending cold emails. That could be by finding an alum from your law school who practices in your area. The other thing I'll say is lawyers love to talk about themselves. They love it. So just give them the opportunity to do it. And so some of the suggestions that I've gotten from people like Carl, people like Karen Vladek, about sort of how to think about building your network have been just sort of eye-opening for me. And it's something that I try to pass on. And it's so funny because I hear different versions among different guests, but when you sort of start piecing each of those together, it almost feels like a path. I haven't got there yet, but I really do think there's some wisdom that we can convey to law students and more junior lawyers just about how to find your community in law.
Well, this goes to your point about what you're ultimately trying to do with the podcast, which is build a library, sort of a reference library, and you'll be able to refer students back to that library when they come and ask you a question and they say, well, how do you develop an amicus practice in the U.S. Supreme Court? And you say, go listen to the episode with Carl Cesari and come back and talk to me. I mean, what a great resource that's going to be for your students eventually. You're well on your way to that.
Absolutely. And I don't always know what we're going to talk about once we start talking, right? I tell lawyers all the time, it's not a deposition, it's a conversation. We'll see where it goes. And you're absolutely right. It's building a library of tips and techniques and approaches and mental models. That's why one of the things that's great to hear is so many people tell me, look, no matter if I'm a long tenured lawyer or brand new, I learn something new every episode. And that's how I feel on the other side of the mic. And I'm sure that's how you all feel. And once you sort of have that bias toward there's going to be a piece of knowledge, I have to listen closely to figure out what it is, the process of listening becomes a blast. The process of creating the podcast becomes a blast. And you build a library over time. I'll also add, I had a woman who I met online. I didn't tell you how it all started. It started because I posted on Twitter, I'm starting this podcast. I had no guests, no episodes. I didn't know how to start a podcast. I had nothing. I said, I'm starting a podcast. I went on Canva, which is like a free design tool, and I designed a logo, which they do not teach you in law school or law professor school. I'm not a designer. And I posted about it. And I had hundreds of people message me and say, make sure you talk about this. Make sure you get this kind of person. And this woman, Pia Owens, reached out to me and she said, look, I'm a tech lawyer. I've done government. I've done in-house. I have some thoughts. I'm a novelist. And I said, great, let's do it. And about 3 months later, I interviewed her. I knew very little about her. Great episode. And I asked for a piece of advice at the end of the episode. And her advice was, just because somebody else tells you to do it does not mean you need to do it. People give you advice about how they either got to where they did or how they think they could get back there if they tried to reverse engineer it. And that was a real like eye-opening statement as somebody who's kind of pushing the idea that listening to other people is a good way to learn how to do it. And her response, I think, was more nuanced than that. I think she would say that. I don't want to put words in her mouth, but is that you got to listen to a lot of advice because no one person's advice is going to sort of put you on the right path. But if you sort of triangulate and listen to enough and critically think about all of them, that's how to find your path.
Well, there's two things that jumped out at me from what you said, Jonah. The first is How I Lawyer is yet another podcast brought to you courtesy of Twitter.
Absolutely. 100%.
Which is exactly what happened with ours. That's exactly how we got started too. And then secondly, I think Jody and I really want to know how you get your wife to listen to your podcast.
Yeah. Not make it about appellate law is probably the key to that.
I'm very lucky. My wife is also a lawyer, but she practices in a totally different area from me. She was a longtime government lawyer and is now in the nonprofit space. And so she is also sort of interested in the legal profession and very supportive of the podcast. And even if your wives don't listen to the podcast, I imagine they feel like they're very supportive of it because it really is an additional piece of work. One huge value, as we talked about, but it's something else on the to-do list.
It is.
Absolutely.
Just as we're kind of closing here in the next few minutes, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of your scholarship that you're working on. And one of the things that you mentioned is you've got an article coming up on authoring digital presentations. Tell us just a little bit about that.
Sure. So this is one of those examples. We talked a little bit earlier about what I've learned from teaching that I wish I could go into practice. This is something that I learned from practice that I wanted to bring into my teaching. So I was surprised when I went to Williams and Connolly, which is a classic big law, all litigation, very DC focused firm. And I came in, I had been a law clerk. I had done everything that I could do in terms of legal writing in school. I was ready to be a great legal writer and write briefs and memos and emails. And I was shocked that when I got there, one of the media, one of the genres of communication that I was asked to communicate in on an almost daily basis was PowerPoint. And having spoken to my students, one of the best parts about being a law professor and having students out in the world is you get to triangulate and hear what they're being asked to do. And I always ask them at the end of the summer, make sure they're prepared for the next summer. I think lawyers increasingly across the profession are being asked to convey information in these digital design-centered forms. And there's a great literature out there on sort of design and law, visual lawyering, but nothing that was sort of targeted at how do I make a PowerPoint presentation? Not in the sense of like, how do I draw the lines and the boxes and where does the text go? But how do I think about this as a document that I'm preparing for a judge, jury, client, internal stakeholder? So I was actually asked about that during my interview at Georgetown. My colleague and friend, Erin Carroll, said to me, and I had never met her before, she said, what have you done in practice that you'd bring into the classroom? And my gut reaction was teach PowerPoint. And I've basically spent the last 3 years trying to figure out how to actually do that answer for my job interview. So thankfully, you know, I worked on this piece. It was a real challenge finishing it during the pandemic with two small kids at home, but that's coming out very soon, hopefully in November, in a wonderful journal that's put out by the Association of Legal Writing Directors. It's a peer-reviewed journal called Legal Communication and Rhetoric, LCNR. And it's publishing my article soon about just that. It's sort of six steps to the process of thinking through how do we convey content in this new format.
That's very cool. And you're absolutely right. I mean, I think about the number of times I see a PowerPoint really weekly, because you see it in court presentations, you see it in CLE presentations, you see it in internal meetings, because it is a great way, short of briefing, to sort of digest an immense amount of information and turn it into something that is usable and easily referred to. So absolutely. I'm glad you're doing that.
If done right.
Right. And right, if absolutely. Done right. And Todd, you're so right. There's such a bias against it, I think, by lawyers, because PowerPoint, they think of as like PowerPoint equals bullet points and corporate speak and bad clip art and bad graphics. It's really hard. You can almost hide behind being a bad formatter when you're writing a brief or a memo, right? There's a lot on social media about how to make a beautiful brief and a beautiful memo, but that's kind of on the outside. It's really hard to hide a presentation. And I will say, I actually think it's harder in some ways to communicate in that genre, because you need to make a lot more choices. You need to make some design choices. Do I convey this on three slides or one? Do I give a bullet point? Do I give an image? Do I give a quote? Do I give a flowchart? Do I give all of those things? And also, and this is what I tell my students, I just taught it. Their presentations are on Monday, so we'll see how they come out. But you need to know the law like you wrote a memo, but you need to be able to present it in four bullet points. And as any lawyer knows, that's not easy. And the audience needs to trust you that you have all the receipts to back everything in that presentation up. And so that's why I sort of wanted to go to first principles. Thankfully, the business community has taken a very different approach. There's a lot of writing out there about how to write a good business presentation. And so I use some of those folks, plus the sort of visual lawyering experts, as my source material. But I also use just my experience of having had to do it, learn it, and now teaching it.
That's awesome. I think that's such a needed piece of scholarship out there, because you're right. Ineffective PowerPoints are just miserable to have to sit through.
Totally, totally. And it's all about your audience. It's like any other piece of legal writing or legal communication. I think the bad PowerPoints are the ones that start by thinking about who's the audience. Often they think of the audience as the person speaking. And that's wrong, right? If you're using your PowerPoint as a teleprompter, you're doing the wrong thing. You have to think about, what is your audience's expectation? Are you going to actually be voicing it over? I mean, one of the things that I had to do a lot in practice was I would create PowerPoints, send them to the client. They would never be presented. That was just the document that they read. That's a very different purpose and audience than a PowerPoint that I'm using to give a CLE or to teach a class. And so knowing those things in the beginning, I mean, that's step one of my process, is know what the purpose is and who the audience is. And I can't tell you how many times that will solve 50% of bad PowerPoints. Once you make the person creating the PowerPoint realize they are not the audience for the document changes significantly.
It makes total sense. And yet I'm glad you said it, because I don't know that I've ever really internalized that concept. But when you say it, it just kind of the aha moment you talked about, that totally clicks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. I'm excited about that article coming out. Because I could use some education on how to do a proper PowerPoint. Let's be honest.
It's all good. Well, I'll say this publicly, which will hold me to it. I have this idea of, once it comes out, maybe sort of between Thanksgiving and the holidays, when people are a little more available, of doing some free online Zooms about the article and about PowerPoint for law professors, for practitioners, for students, just to sort of spread it in a different medium. Not bore any podcast listeners with it, but be able to push this scholarship out like we talked about at the beginning. The scholarship could just sit in a journal, and I'm grateful to the journal for publishing it and for editing it and for being there. But now it's my job to get it into the hands of people who can need it. And as we discussed, it's not that hard in today's day and age to make that happen. So I'm committed to trying to find ways to connect to the right people who need more advice on something I've been thinking a lot about.
Well, if you're ever interested in doing a remote CLE on that in Texas, I have a feeling that Todd and I could probably find some ways to make that happen. So
totally.
Let us know if you feel like you really want to do that. And I think we probably could get some resources for you on that.
I love that. I'm excited about it. Before long, I'm going to turn into a Texan just by hanging out with all these people on Appel at Twitter.
Well, one other project that you mentioned that I'm curious to hear a little bit more about is sort of empathy and judicial writing. Tell me about that.
Sure. So one of the things they tell you when you become a professor is you need to sort of decide what your area of scholarship is going to be or what your scholarly agenda is going to look like. That's one of those things that I think is hard to do before you start experimenting with projects. But the area that I'm really excited about is thinking about legal communication and audience. So that's why the PowerPoint or presentation article fits in, is it's a new genre with a new audience. The next audience that I want to look at in my upcoming scholarship is about the audience for judicial opinions. And there's some great scholarship out there. I mean, a lot about opinion writing and the content of opinions. There's also a lot of scholarship on what it means to be an empathetic judge. And that goes back to debates that go back to the Chief Justice's confirmation hearing where he talked about balls and strikes. Goes back to then Senator Obama when he was running for president saying we need empathetic judges. But what I'm really interested in is less about the judges and their empathy and more about what makes judicial opinions and judicial writing empathetic. And this comes back candidly to my mentor who recently passed away, Judge Katzman, who early on in my clerkship said to us, no matter what, I want people who interact with me or with the Second Circuit or with my opinions to feel like they are heard, to feel like the law is coming from a reasoned position and that they are feeling respected. And that doesn't matter if they lose. That doesn't matter if they have total disrespect for the law, that the law has to show, and this is again, a little bit adding my own spin on it, but show empathy in how we convey information to the many audiences of judicial opinions. And look, the audiences of judicial opinions have changed, right? We don't live in the world anymore where the only people who read an opinion were the parties, right? And maybe some lawyer in the middle of the night who opened a book and found the opinion and is going to cite to it. Opinions are read widely. Mm-hmm. They're posted on Twitter, right? They can be read by anybody. You don't even need a Westlaw or Lexis account anymore to read judicial opinions. So as our audience has changed, and this is my personal bias, think that the writing needs to change. How we convey the opinion may need to change. But before we sort of say, well, how should it change? What I'm looking at is what does it mean for writing, specifically judicial opinion writing, to show empathy, to at its highest level, put yourself in the various reader's shoes. And so I'm thinking about that and I'm reading about that, and I hope I have some answers before too long. But at the very least, as with all scholarship, right, it's about starting the conversation. And I think shifting the focus from empathetic judging to empathetic judicial writing is a really exciting project for me. Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting. I'll be very interested to hear kind of where you go with that, because that is something that is very needed. And you're right, as we have changed the consumers of judicial opinions, you have also, I think, seen a shift in the way that those are written, and not always for the better, but I think you really can see judges writing for a different audience than even maybe 10 or 15 years ago when I started practicing.
Right. And maybe that's good, right? Maybe they are shifting and they're writing to a new audience. But I think if we don't think critically about what that audience wants, needs, and deserves, then we're doing a disservice. If a judge ultimately ends up deciding to go a different way and choose to write in what I might call an unempathetic way, that's their prerogative. But at the very least, being able to sort of think through, well, if I wanted to think about my audience better, what would I need to think about?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've gone a little over our usual time.
Yeah, absolutely.
But with great conversation.
Yes.
And it's been worth every minute, but we don't want to let you escape, Jonah, without complying with our tradition of asking our guests for a tip or a war story as sort of a parting thought. Do you have anything for us?
Yeah. So as someone who only practiced for a short period of time, I'm going to go the tip route as opposed to the war story route, and I'm going to connect it to my own practice. and sort of my current scholarship, since that's what we were just talking about. And my tip is that to be a good lawyer, you need to know who your audience is. And that could be as a writer. That's something I learned very, very early on at Williams and Connolly, was that your audience isn't always the judge. It can be the opposing counsel. It could be the client. It could be the opposing business entities of that client. The audience can be a lot of different things in legal communication. And that's true also for who you spend your time with, right? Who's your audience for your everyday successes? One of the greatest parts, and this is how I met you all, right, is on social media. One of the things I love about social media, specifically Twitter and sort of law Twitter and appellate Twitter, is how everyone is so supportive of everyone's successes. And this idea, or as I think about it, like the rising tide raises all ships, which is the exact opposite of what so much of lawyering lore is about, right? Of sort of the zero sum game and the people tearing pages out of the textbook. So I guess my suggestion is know who your audience is. And I'll add, if you don't have an audience, go get one. That's true for someone who's just starting law school or someone who's been practicing for 40 years and feels like they're in a rut. The greatest way to sort of jumpstart your professional life is to go develop an audience. And we live in a time when you can do that with real ease if you're willing to be empathetic, kind, thoughtful, and you're willing to go out on a limb a little bit and share about your own experience, share about yourself, share your wins, share your losses, build in public. Those are all things that will increase your audience as a lawyer. And I think I'm taking a bet that being a lawyer in the 21st century will be better if you do it with an audience.
I like that.
Yeah, me too. It's a great place to wind up. Jonah, thanks for spending the time with us. We really enjoyed visiting with you, and we know our listeners will enjoy hearing your thoughts on all these topics too. So really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, both of you. And hopefully we'll make this a home and home and get you guys to come on How I Lawyer at some point, maybe sometime in 2021. I look forward to it.
If we can make the cut, I don't know.
That's right.
Well, I'll have to ask some of the former Texas guests if you guys make the cut. No, I'm just joking. I think it'll be great. We'll have a blast.
Sounds great. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.